You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 251 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Wenton, Washington, home of Russell Wilson for now, and the Seattle Seahawks. More on that later.
Yeah, a little foreshadowing there. We're going to get to that very shortly, but first we should mention, if you haven't checked it out already, did a great interview, the second episode of our Seattle Chef series with Monica Demas of Little Neon Taco, Sunset Fried Chicken, and Westman's Bagel and Coffee that dropped on Monday. And that after we recorded that, we got news that Little Neon Taco is moving from its former space on First Hill and will reopen as a pop-up next Thursday at La Dive, a natural wine shop on Capitol Hill for takeout and delivery. So be sure to check
that. We could have broken this news, Monica.
Apparently we could have, but yeah.
She was in the kitchen at Little Neon Taco. Didn't let us break the news.
Wasn't ready. Didn't know. I guess we should have mentioned that the podcast wasn't coming out until after that went public.
Also, I have to mention, I had Pagliacci pizza yesterday, extra pepperoni. Is there anything better than a super fresh Pagliacci pizza? Just that extra pepperoni, when it's got the little bit of grease and the cheese is perfectly melted. We pulled up to the Bellevue Botanical Gardens. I was like, fuck it, I'm eating three slices right here in the parking lot. I can't not eat this pizza when it's fresh. It is literally perfect.
Oh, it's so much better when it's fresh.
Oh my God. Anyway, it was just such a beautiful pizza experience.
I'm going to get some Pagliacci over the weekend. I'm very excited about it. It's been too long. This week's beer, as we get started, the Other Coast Hazy IPA from Two Beers Brewing Company. Tropical, citrusy, and verdant. This hazy IPA's aroma is bursting with guava, pineapple, and citrus peel. Notes of orange pith, Meyer lemon, and soft vanilla ester on the palate give way to a pleasantly clean and lightly bitter finish.
There we go, but not the best sandwich in Seattle.
I mean, it would have been appropriate had we eaten Other Coast sandwiches to go with the Other Coast beer, but alas, we did not work that out.
I would gladly.
It's been much too long since I've had an Other Coast sandwich, that's for sure. So we've got a few toasts to get here this week. It's a Sue Bird Megan Rapinoe heavy edition of the toasts, starting with the news that Sue Bird has officially re-signed on Monday for her 20th season with the Storm, including two that she sat out due to injury. So her 18th season on the court and going for championship number 5 in Seattle.
The only bad news about this is that it's delaying the start of Sue Bird's coaching career.
She's going to have plenty of time, whatever it is, coaching, front office, broadcasting. She'll have plenty of time to get to that. So no rush into retirement. Speaking of that couple, that Seattle power couple, Seattle's first couple, her fiance, Megan Rapinoe, was the high scorer with 3 goals in 3 matches as the U.S. women's national team swept Argentina, Brazil, and Canada to win the She Believes Cup. And Rapinoe then confirmed that she's planning to rejoin OL Reign after sitting out the team's 2020 competitions. Her quote postgame, "I'm really excited to get back in the NWSL. Obviously, I took all the time that I could possibly take last year, but I think it really did me well. I think the NWSL and all the teams and players have done an incredible job with all the protocols and keeping everybody safe. So I'm looking forward to getting back with the team."
There we go.
So excited to see Rapinoe again in a Reign jersey. Then last Saturday, as we mentioned on the pod last week, the Seattle Sports Star of the Year Awards. Congrats to Seahawks linebacker KJ Wright and Seattle U-guard Mackenzie Williams were voted the Seattle Sports Stars of the Year, while the Storm's championship run was naturally named the Sports Story of the Year. Okay, with the toasts in the book, I think we should get directly to our interview this week because we got a lot more information on the Russell Wilson situation directly from the source. Well, not Russell Wilson. With the Russell Wilson news last week being reported by The Athletic Seattle, there was only one person to go to off of a now legendary appearance at last year's PeltonCast Live. Back then we were talking, let Russ cook. Now the question is, will Russ leave? Please welcome back to the pod from The Athletic, Seattle, Michael Sean Dugar.
What up? What up? I forgot about, yeah, that was fun. I got to tell that wedding story on here, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that was a good time. That was a really good, I just told this for the first time to someone, like when I told my mom that story, I think like a week or two ago, and she hadn't heard it, and she was just blown away by it. Yeah, it's good times.
You referenced a wedding on your last Man to Man podcast, and I was wondering whether that was the same wedding.
What was the reference? Because I've been to a couple weddings now.
About wearing shorts at a wedding. Now that you said it was in Seattle, so I think maybe it wasn't.
Yes. Okay. So yeah, I was trying to wear shorts to a different wedding, another wedding that I was in. It was in October. It was the weekend of that. It was like a Rams Seahawks Thursday night game. It was perfect because the wedding was on a Saturday, so I didn't have to work or travel. It was great. And yeah, I wanted to wear like Coug gear because my homie is a Coug, and I wanted to wear like shorts. And I had sent in to the bride like ideas that like LeBron James and Chris Paul and like these shorts that were also suits. They may have another name, but like I was like, this is dope. Like, we can pull this off. And the bride was just like, hell no, we're not going to do that.
At least you were coordinating it. I was like, wait, you're trying to wear shorts to a wedding that you're in? Okay.
Yeah, no, all of us though. Yeah, not just me pulling up in shorts. Yeah, no, that's a good, yeah. Very good clarification. Yeah, I wasn't just trying to like be all relaxed for the sake of being relaxed. I was just like, let's all be relaxed, you know, in unison, then it'll work. But no, she shot it down quickly.
Well, we'll see if we get back into weddings, but for now, we should probably start by talking about the news of the week, which broke just after we recorded last week. And it felt like, you know, kind of paying attention to what you were saying, I wasn't stunned that this story dropped. How long had this been in the works, which was a collaboration between you and your colleagues at The Athletic, Mike Sando and Jason Jenks?
Yeah, it was very hard. Anyone who's listened to like our podcast, the Seahawks Man to Man podcast, for like the last, I want to say like 6 weeks, like we've been like tiptoeing around, all in like on dysfunction. You know, I made a bunch of analogies about pizza and stuff like that. I'm just like trying to let people know like, hey, this is worse than the on-field product is telling us that it is. And the on-field product was telling us it was actually very bad, you know, and it was very hard, you know, to hold on to it. And actually was going to hold on to everything all offseason. And then Russell went on that little media run where he was on like CBS. He did the Cowherd Show. And once he starts doing the Cowherd Show, it gets all bad, right? That's usually when the big rumors come out there. And then he did the deep Dan Patrick, Walter Payton Man of the Year. And then I think it might have been Jenks's idea or the homie Steve Cohen, who was like our editor on the project. Used to work for the PI editor at The Athletic now. It might have been him that was like, we got to do something. Like, we have to. This is the thing, because I was just going to write like a little column. I actually still have it. I did like a draft column the week of all of that and was like, you know, here's my thoughts. Here's what Russell's trying to tell us. And then I think Steve was like, nah, let's do the big joint. Let's just wait, even if it takes us 2-3 weeks, which it did. And I still had to do all these radio things and all these podcasts and just say a lot without saying anything at all. Like our podcast before the week before the Russ story dropped, I think it dropped like 7 days before, it was so hard. I had to run everything by my co-host Chris and be like, look, okay, so here's everything I know. We can only say about 5% of that right now. It was like very, very hard to do. So when the story was final and we got to do our actual pod, I think I opened the show saying like, Chris, I'm relieved. It was like holding on to government secrets for a little bit, just because we knew how big it would be. So it was on my side, I had been hearing stuff for months. But I think in terms of the work that me, Jenks, and Sando did, that was probably like, we dropped on the 25th, Super Bowl's on the 7th. So however many days that is in between, like 2.5 weeks or something like that of just reporting, talking to people, getting no text back, you know, just empty emails and a bunch of DMs to people who just read them and didn't respond. A lot of reporting in 2021. And finally got a product out that was pretty dope.
Do you feel like during that time period that you were working on things that you uncovered even more than you'd originally known?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, okay, so I give an example. I knew about Russ storming out of that meeting shortly after it actually happened. And so that's what, like November or something? So that was like a not new thing. But I think the Russ talking to Pete after the Super Bowl, obviously, was very new. I did not know that, that happened. Even watching Jason Lockenfour's like frustration tweet, I was like, ah, it's probably kind of nothing. And then I think the Dan Patrick Show came out the next morning, and I was like, oh, wait, no, this is something. Make a few phone calls. Oh, okay. Now I get it. Like, that was one of the new things that I had that we uncovered. Obviously, the trade stuff. That wasn't my reporting specifically, but that was something that was new that I had not known. It got to the point where it was like, you know, we don't want to trade, but since you bring up the word trade, here's like seven teams that we'd be okay with going to. That means they thought about it. I think let's go with another example. Oh, the little anecdote there about Nate Carroll being upset about his job. Another thing I'd known for a little bit, but just kind of heard. No, not something I could report, tweet, not even speculate, because it would be irresponsible. Yes, we still do that, kids. We don't just tweet everything we get. I know it seems like we do, but we don't. I heard that months ago, but wasn't able to like really confidently put that in a story until we did some more digging. So yeah, those are a few things. I mean, most of the explosive elements of it, to be honest, were relatively new, or we got new information on. Oddly enough, the opening scene of Russ storming out is the thing that like, nah, I had known that for a little bit. But see, that's a good example. Imagine knowing that in like week 12. and you're supposed to, it's your job to talk about the Seahawks twice a week. And it's just like, I can't really say that, you know, because I knew it, but it's like, you got to really work hard to get stuff like that. Because as you can see, it'll be a big deal.
It's one of those like impressive skills when people develop it, like watching Woj kind of work his way around what he knows, but what he's actually allowed to say, because I think that's one of the things that people sometimes on the outside don't realize is there's a lot of stuff that you know, but you're told it in a way that it's not to be used, or you don't have it nailed down, and you kind of can inform what you're saying, but you can't say it directly.
Yeah, it's very, very, I was honestly proud of our podcast that came out like the 18th. Like that was, I'm telling you, it was really like an hour long, not an hour long, I mean like a 30-minute convo with Chris, my co-host. And I was like, dude, okay, so that's all this great juicy stuff. We can't even talk about it, right? And I just want you to know it, you know, so you kind of have the backdrop. I mean, even something as simple as, what's another good example? That I just kind of broke, quote unquote, mostly shout out to Sando, but I broke that Tater was coming back. Right? That's the thing we knew like last week. You know, I didn't put out the thing till Sunday. You know, you got to hold, you know, just got to hold stuff. Like it's stuff like that. Deshaun Shedd coming back. There's one more. Oh, Tracy Smith. Yeah, no, it's a very difficult thing. I mean, no one cares unless you're like in the media, but like Woj, Schefter, Rappaport, all everyone who's got sourcing, like even someone like Cowherd who talks every day, you know, and then here's a lot of stuff I'm sure has to dance around what he can say, what he can't say. Like you got to be really careful of that, and you can't let it slip, because as soon as you start letting stuff slip, people stop telling you stuff, and you gotta be, once people stop telling you stuff, your value drops, and then you're just kind of known as a snitch. And you definitely don't want to be that.
All right, well, let's unpack some of this stuff, go deeper on it. My first question is, do you feel like Russell Wilson's and his camp are kind of daring the Seahawks to trade him in a way? Like, clearly, they know that what they're doing, this media tour, you know, the way that Russell Wilson is talking very differently than any other point in his career, they have to know that it's going to bother the Seahawks organization, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the point. Honestly, I was thinking about this like a couple hours ago. I was like, man, because Russell's smart. Like, he gets the, understands football, understands the business of football, economics of the game. Like, he's a very smart guy. So, like, he understands that he can't be in charge of picking, like, players, like, legitimately scouting them and signing them. So, like, he's probably not asking for a ton of say or control. So, like, how dismissive do you have to be of a guy like Russell for him to do this? You know, it's not just like he asked for a small thing, or it's not like he asked for, hey, can I like be in charge of drafting all our next linemen? And he was like, well, no. And he gets all mad and goes on to Dan Patrick. So, no, of course not. Like, that means I get the feeling he got his ideas totally dismissed, like was told nothing, left completely in the dark. I don't know that for sure. That's why I was going to tweet that earlier. I just couldn't word it the right way. But like, I've been thinking about that a lot, because they know what they're doing. They're trying to put fire under, you know, light fire under the organization. But like, I know they've tried that privately, you know, so imagine how just like dismissive Pete and John must have came across to them to be like, no, we're going to take this national. Like, we're to the point where, and this is anyone who's downplaying this on the media side is really tripping. Like, this is real. Like, look, Mark Rogers went on the record and told ESPN, yeah, nah, there's our four teams. You know, if they went to, that's a very big deal. Like, they know what they're doing, Mark and Russell and the rest of the camp. They obviously know. But I've taken it a step further, kind of like, man, they must really have given Russell nothing, like really nothing. Not even like a, like, here's some old linemen we might be thinking about. Like, I think even that he'd like would suffice, you know, for like, hey, who are we going after? You know, our O-line stinks. What are we looking at? Don't worry about it. We got it. Okay, well, hold on. Like, I can understand Russell's if that's the case. I don't know if that is, but I imagine they're not even giving him that. Because Russell is not like an irrational guy to understand, you know what I mean? He understands what power he has and does not have. But they must have really just been like, dude, don't worry, trust us. And he was like, why would I do that? My ribs hurt every Monday, you know, after playing the Rams. I'm not going to trust you. So yeah, I think they're definitely trying to light the fire, and it's working. I think. I mean, look at this. The whole world. This is the biggest sports story in the NFL offseason thus far, depending on how you feel about the Stafford trade. You know, that's saying a lot.
Do you think that it's working? When you say it's working, do you think it's working internally within the organization? Or what are you seeing as the response from the Pete and John in the front office?
I think that they don't be on Twitter and stuff like that, like John and Pete, but they're aware, you know, like Pete is probably one of the more media savvy NFL coaches, you know, because he's a legit celebrity. You know, I think outside of perhaps John Gruden, Pete Carroll is the only like legit celebrity among the NFL head coach. The other guys are just kind of famous, you know, in the NFL world, but like people know Pete Carroll, people know John Gruden as thanks to being on TV and thanks to USC. So like they know them. So he knows the game. But stuff like this is a lot easier to ignore when it's just like a contentious phone call between he and Russ or something. Like he can kind of let that rock. He can't let that rock when everyone's blowing up his phone. It's all over the place and becomes a distraction. If nothing else, it's become that. It's become something you're forced to deal with, right? Because now you have to like take these calls. I think someone just wrote a column. I want to say it was like Albert Breer that clearly reads as if it came from like the team side. Like it, you use some language like the Seahawks who have bent over backwards to, you know, help Russell. Like that clearly sounds like a team thing. I don't know that for sure on Breer's part, but, you know, read between the lines. So like he's having to do that. Like they have to now talk to, you know, Schefters and Rappaports and here and talk to their people. And like other players are probably calling Pete and, you know, what's up? You know, they're trying to do all these things or answer all these questions that don't involve making the team better. So that's the part that probably has forced John and Pete to like be thrust into action, whether it's answer some calls or, you know, just do something, you know, just force them to pay attention because it does. Again, it sounds like they were so dismissive that like Russ didn't feel heard. You know, it's almost like a kid, you know, asking for something and your parent says no, and then just goes in the living room and just stomps and closes, you know, like I need you to get I need to get your attention. So I haven't like done a lot of digging on terms of if it is working. I just know Pete Carroll that when stuff becomes a thing, he feels the need to address it. And I know, I guarantee this has become a distraction, you know, within the building. And it's the most important player, right? It's not like the long snapper is upset. It's Russell Wilson. You know, and you have to fix that before you can do anything else with your offseason. So Pete probably didn't want to respond to this. Actually, I'm pretty sure he does not, but like he's been forced to, not just because of what Russell said, but then our report too, which is basically born out of, you know, all the things that Russell has said over the past like 2 weeks.
I mean, I think that's an important point because it's not just that he's the most important player on the roster. He is the most important person. I mean, it does feel like if it got to the point where Russell Wilson said, you know, it's Pete Carroll, whether that's him or in John Schneider is an extension or just Pete specifically or me, it does feel like the organization would probably stick with the coach that they just extended through 2025. But that is a nonsensical decision when you talk about a quarterback who's still in his late prime versus a coach who is Pete Carroll's age.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. People have been asking me, like, on a national media circuit, they're like, all right, how are people in Seattle reacting? And I'm like, yo, it's a civil war over here. Like, you just pop into Seahawks Twitter, and it's Team Pete, it's Team Russ. And then there's some nuanced stuff in the middle, which, you know, for sure, as there should be. Believe it or not, as crazy as Seahawks Twitter gets, I do get a sense it's a lot more nuanced than some other fan bases. Like, that's a low bar, of course. But, like, I do get, like, even something like Let Russ Cook is, like, super nuanced, right? Because even in that, it's not let's run the air raid. no one behind that is with that, right? Because that's all the way to the, you know, the other side of the spectrum. It's just like, no, let's just pass more on earlier downs. Like, that's a pretty nuanced take for a fan base to be in agreement on, you know, like that's, I give them some credit there. Like, I don't think that's something that you could come up with if you're an NFC East fan base on Twitter. Those fan bases are pretty bad. I think I've dumped on them before. But yeah, I think, man, this, if you had to choose, I personally, I think I might've tweeted this or wrote it somewhere. I would probably roll with Russell, who's probably like, it's just so hard to find, you know, a quarterback. It really is. Like, look at the people who get fired. You usually get fired when you don't have a quarterback, right? It's very hard to get like fired when you have like an elite quarterback. It happens. I mean, Mike McCarthy is probably hearing that, like, dude, what are you talking about? It's very easy to get fired, actually. But I guess I think that's relatively rare, considering like other coaching fires. So I would probably go, all right, if Russ is pissed and Pete's pissed and you got to choose, all right, give me the 8-time Pro Bowler, right? And we'll figure out, you know, the rest. Not to say you can just find another Pete Carroll, but your percentages of finding another Pete are higher than finding another Russell to me.
Yes.
That's just kind of how I looked at it. I don't know if Jody Allen will look at it. I don't know. You talk about somebody who doesn't want to deal with none of this. Jody's probably sitting there. Whoever told Jody probably got the scorned face. It's like, wait, what? Russell said what? Where? His agent sent what? To who? What do we just won the division. You know, like that's probably like, it's a simplistic view. I don't know Jody, but I can imagine, since she's pretty hands off, the last thing she wants to be dealing with is whether to like get rid of the GM she extended to 2027, the coach she extended to 2025, or the quarterback who's on the books till 2023. Like, those are the three people you do not want to be like trying to decide the future on in February and March.
One, I think you have to look at who is almost certainly has Jody Allen's ear between Russell Wilson as the quarterback and then Pete and John in the front office. And I wonder if part of this is just, it's sort of, you know, Russ and his agent looking at the situation and saying, this isn't going to get better anytime soon. We can't wait out this coach and this front office for a year or two, and then all of a sudden it'll get better. This could be the rest of Russell Wilson's career operating inside of both an offense that's not necessarily the most quarterback friendly, even if they are talking about bringing in an offensive coordinator who probably will be running hypothetically a more quarterback friendly scheme. We don't know yet, but also if he's not being heard now, he won't be heard ever. You know, Russell Wilson is at the prime in his career. And if they can't hear him in this year, when he played for a part of it, the best he's ever played, will there ever be a time that this coach and this front office are going to listen to Russell Wilson? And they're probably going to outlast Russell Wilson if push comes to shove.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not getting heard after you throw 40 touchdowns, yeah, like, when are you going to hear me? You know, and that's, again, simplistic. He also threw 13 interceptions, which might be a career high, but he threw a lot. So I'm like, yeah, to your point, I was thinking about this earlier today too. This story has consumed me even after it's published, as you can see. I was thinking, like, if you're Russ's people, are you trying to get a message to Jody as well? You know, is it just that like, okay, Pete's not hearing me, John's not hearing me, whoever's not hearing me, Matt Thomas, their salary cap guy, none of them are hearing me. So you're maybe not, it's like that kid I mentioned in the analogy, maybe he's not going in the living room to stomp to get the parent. And it's like to get grandma or something like that, like to get whoever is the other authority figure. I was thinking about that earlier too, because if I'm Russell and it's hypothetical, if I'm Russell and I can't get Pete to even pick up the phone or something, let's say not answer, well, what am I going to do? Like, what legitimately do I do to be heard? Well, I have to go above his head. Why do I go above his head? You know, he's really his own boss. Well, the only person is, you know, whoever, I think it's Vulcan or whatever, that owns the team, and Jody. Like, how do I get to them? Can I just send a text? Probably not. You know, can I leave a voicemail? Who's checking those in 2021? Well, maybe I have to just burn the whole thing down, you know, publicly. You know, I don't know for sure if that's like the thinking, but it does make a lot of sense, you know, because one of their gripes, mentioned the Nate Carroll like anecdote, one of the gripes is that there's no accountability in the building on, you know, the part of anyone whose last name is Carroll. So what can you possibly do about that other than forcing yourself out is to go above Carroll, and that would be to ownership. Now that is when I'm not sure whether that's working. I have nothing. I don't even know what Jody looks like, to be quite honest. I know her pictures on the website, I just never looked. It's not like her email's there or anything. So, like, if I was trying to get a message to them, this would probably be how I do it. I mean, because there's no greater way, I think, as the quarterback to get a message across to literally everyone in the building other than requesting a trade. Tell Adam Schefter you want to trade and everybody hear you. Like, legitimately everyone, you know, in the country will hear you if you're the superstar quarterback and you request a trade. So, like, if my goal was to wake up Jody, like, if I'm Russell's camp, this was the 100% correct way to do it. And I think it was the only way, probably, short of, like, showing up at her house.
Let's hope that Vulcan has Schefter on text alert.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that sort of leads to, you know, this question we've been talking around. Is the end goal here more to light a fire under the organization to create change, or to light a fire under the organization to force them to trade him, even though they do not want to trade him? And as we've talked about in the past, from a salary cap standpoint, it is not an ideal time to trade Russell Wilson this offseason.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because I was watching, I've been trying to like watching the national coverage of this and like First Take and stuff like that, mostly to see if anyone says my name selfishly. It's been kind of cool. That's been kind of fun. We worked on this for so long, so it's like to take this little victory lap has been great. Did like 15 radio shows last week. But, you know, I think the end goal, Russell's not dumb, right? So like, even if, I think it was like on First Take, like, someone was saying that none of his trade destinations make any sense. Actually, that might have been like Bill Barnwell actually said that. And I was like, well, I didn't listen to it. It was on the ESPN Daily, but I was like, well, of course they don't, right? But you need some names, right? You have to put some out there, right? Otherwise, no one cares, right? And they have to sound like somewhat legitimate. And maybe you throw in a couple that don't make sense, like the Bears or something like that, or the Jets or whatever. But you have to have those out there whether you want to stay or not. So when I think about Russell's end game, I do think he wants to be here. Like, I legitimately believe that. I think Mark Rogers told Adam Schefter that, and I don't think that was lip service. Russell's not dumb. His best bet at winning a championship as soon as possible is Seattle. Doesn't mean it will happen soon, but I do think that is his best bet. I think second place would probably be New Orleans, but I do think what they would have to, I mean, A, they're in cap hell, like of the most of anyone in the league. They don't have a quarterback. Right. So like they have people that need to pay. Like, I don't think they've paid Marshawn Lattimore yet. Like, he probably going to break the bank on them. They're going to have to dump a bunch of people just to be, you know, in out of the red. But I think from Russell's view, it was like, pair me with Sean Payton, we'll get it done. But even then, it's like Drew Brees probably thought the same thing. Russell, like, you know, that's your idol. And you've been to Super Bowl twice as many times as Drew, you know, and like half the time or whatever. So I think Seattle, he wants to be here. Just wants them to get it right. It really is more about pressure than I want to get out. Now, has he reached a point where he's willing to leave if that's what it comes to? I think you have to. I don't think you can go this far on a bluff.
Yeah.
So I think that part is real. But ultimately, I think Russ and his camp are smart enough to know that, like, even if you hate Pete and think he's a, you know, dinosaur with an antiquated scheme and no one holds him accountable, I think you guys just won 12 games together, right? And you guys win a lot of games together every year. You guys could hate each other and probably win 10 next year, right? Like, that's just your best bet, I think. But I think he needs to let the organization know, and probably the world know, like, I'm not just going to keep staying here forever if I don't have to. You know? So I think he wants to be here, but, like, he also legitimately, probably for, like, the first time in his career, is, like, willing to bounce if that's what has to come to, like, chase Tom Brady.
Okay, what about the news that we got today, which was not great news for the Seahawks and kind of proves Russell Wilson's point in a lot of ways. But with J.J. Watt signing with the Cardinals, you look at the pass rushers around the NFC West and, you know, it's brutal. Most of the best pass rushers in the NFL were playing in the NFC West at the moment and facing off against this weak Seahawks offensive line. It makes sense for them to invest in the offensive line. It's not, Russell isn't wrong when he says this. Do you think that, I guess if you had to put yourself in Russell Wilson's head, what do you think he was thinking today when that J.J. Watt signing happened?
Well, he was swimming with sharks last night, and it probably was like a little bit of a metaphor to like be surrounded by sharks and then wake up and then J.J. Watt's in your division. It's just like a perfect, it's like a nightmare that doesn't end. But I mean, Russell, it's not even about that they need to invest. They just be better at it, right? Like, if you're Russell, that's why I really think I'm imagining the conversation after the Super Bowl. But I imagine it probably went something like, hey, can we have better linemen? Like, who are we going to go after? Tell me. You know, I think he wanted like Jack Conklin last year and they didn't go get him. They went and got Brandon Schell. You know, like even if Brandon Schell's fine, it's like if you're Russell, it's like I'd rather just have Jack. You know what I'm saying? Especially considering the money that they spent elsewhere. And if the organization doesn't tell them or they say anything that implies have faith in us, I think we use that implore to have faith. Why in the world would I trust you guys to be any good at finding O-line, whether it's free agency, whether it's drafting? I mean, how many legitimately good linemen have they drafted or signed or traded for since 2012? Like it's a low hit rate. Now, is it low relative to the rest of the league? I don't know. I'd have to go look. O-linemen are just hard to find. I've been telling people all week too, the O-line is very hard because like, they're big dudes, right? So the population doesn't produce that. You're already dealing with a small size just from the American population, right? So that's a problem. You need five of them. You don't need any, that's the most of any position you need on the field at any given time is five for the most part to stay on the field at the same time. Obviously you can have five DBs or something, but for the most part, you need five fat dudes on the field at all times, 100% time, like all within like the same type of age and skill set, you know, and making wages that fit under the cap while the rest of your team is good. That's very hard, right? That's very hard, especially because college is not producing a bunch with all this spread stuff going on. So like, but still, if you're Russell, it's like, okay, try, right? Let's do something different. Because whatever you guys do does not work. You know, I think even if Russell played like a style of offense that doesn't lend itself to a lot of hits the way he does, you guys know he's running around back there. He just does it. You know, sacks are a QB stat. Even if that wasn't the case, if he was even a more stationary guy or whatever, I think he'd still be high up there in sacks, right? Because he has legitimately played behind battle lines. So I think it's a lack of faith really on Russell's part. I think that's driving it. As much as anything, like if you tell me, Russ, we got this, a lot that goes into it. Okay, sure, guys. You said that before and you brought me Luke Jokel. You know, like, why am I trust you guys to fix this? And they probably can't have a legitimately good answer for that, I don't think. That said, I don't know how the answer could be go to the Raiders where Tom Cable is there. Now, I know, like, their O-line is, like, a lot better in recent years, and Colton Miller is got his ass kicked by Frank Clark in London and now is like going to be due for like an extension over there. It's very weird how Tom Cable has turned that thing around. But if I'm Russell, the last person I want building the O-line around me again is Tom Cable. But like, yeah, the gist to answer your question, I'd want input too, because you guys not having my input sucks, right? It legitimately gets me beat down. No, by the end of the year. So, I mean, even look at the last few years. Look at the Green Bay game. Look at the Dallas game that they lost in the playoffs. Like, you can blame a lot of what happened there on some O-line issues. That and being unable to cover Davante Adams. But, like, they're getting their butt whooped in Dallas that year up front. Right? And with Russell, like, okay, we don't have to do that. I really legitimately don't think Russell has much faith in those guys to build an offensive line around him. I don't blame him. He's been playing behind bad O-lines for the better part of a decade.
I mean, honestly, a lot of Russell Wilson's complaints here sound like they could be coming from the Seahawks fan base. Like, there was a faith in Pete Carroll and John Schneider that existed 5 years ago that is not the same at this point because of the fact that, you know, as successful as they have continued to be and as much as they've continued to win the division, the biggest reason for that is Russell Wilson at this point. So especially if you're him and you're taking that out of the equation, which I suppose leads to an interesting question, which is, to what extent do you think that the Seahawks fan base in the Let Russ Cook movement played a role in this? Do you think he was going to be as frustrated with everything that had happened otherwise? Do you think, and even not just the existence of the phrase, but also the fact that he had this opportunity to play a different style and was as successful as he was early in the season, and then they shifted back from that. You got a taste of it. And then you found out that I can't continue doing that. Do you think that's part of the frustration here too?
I think he's always, and this is why I give Seahawks Twitter a little bit of credit here. Like, yes, Russell does just sound like he's go 12-37-4 online, right? Because he's saying all the things that people have been saying online for a long time, right? Like, if you're Seahawks Twitter is not a bunch of, I mean, there's a lot of dumb people on there, but like, there's some legitimately good arguments on there. Some of them that the quarterback agrees with. Like, he came out there and said, "I'm tired of getting hit." It's like, well, we're tired of watching you get hit, right? Like, it's we feel you, but no, I don't think it was necessarily driven by like the idea to be able to trademark the thing and all that. Like, that was a cool like side effect, but I think another part about you know, this, and we had this in one of the drafts of the story. It was when one of my sections, it got trimmed down, but I think it's really important to know that Russell sees these guys come out of the blue, it feels like, and have these great seasons in systems that like are built around what they do best. And you look at like 2015 Cam Newton, 2016 Matt Ryan, like relatively speaking, these are, I know those are first round picks, but they came out of the blue with their MVP seasons, you know, for the most part, which they've never been that close, that good since then, especially not Cam and Matt Ryan's 2016 season looks like an aberration almost now. You know, even like 2017 Carson Wentz for a little bit, all of Brady's career for the most part. And then it continues. It's like 2018, Russell was probably about as good as you're going to be in a run first offense, trying to throw in the ball. Okay, but here comes the Holmes and throws 50 touchdowns, right? Like, that's insane. The very next year, Russ is cooking again. Or first nine games last year, he was on fire then, too. Hell, Lockett was killing it. Here comes Lamar Jackson, you know, and all of these guys, Russell views them as dudes who thrive because of what's around them, not in spite. So I think that Let Russ Cook just kind of gave it like a fancy little slogan for him to like attach it to, but he's always felt that way, even if he didn't have a slogan to put it on. He's always felt like, how come these guys get to thrive because of, and I have to thrive in spite of, you know, whether it, regardless of how much I'm throwing or whatever, I do think that's the part that is bugging. Because also, again, those, I just named a bunch of MVPs aside from Carson Wentz, who was going to win it before he blew his knee out. Like, that's guys who are getting what Russell Wilson wants. And I'm sure Russell thinks he's better than everyone I just named, right? Bunch of guys I think he's better than going to Super Bowls. How many, all of those guys went to Super Bowls, actually. That I just, no, except for Lamar. And obviously Carson didn't play. But yeah, everyone went to Super Bowls in that run. Just all those guys I just mentioned. Like, so not only are they succeeding in systems that, you know, like highlight what they do well, not only are they getting the individual accolades of, you know, MVP, like they're going to the Super Bowl where Russ wants to be. You know, that's a triple win. Like, that's heavy on a dude who wakes up and wants to like piss excellence and be great. You know, like, I can see why that's always been in Russell. And again, I think Let Russ Cook was just kind of the, oh, okay, cool. Like, you got, we got a name for it now? Bet. Let me text that to Pete then. So I don't, it's probably a long-winded thing. And it's like, all right, cool. Now I can just text him, let me cook. You know, I think that's always been there in him.
I want to go back to the Nate Carroll story. That was an interesting anecdote. So was his frustration that he didn't have a larger role in the Seahawks coaching staff?
That's my understanding of the situation. Yeah, as you can see, our details are kind of vague there and intentionally so. That's one of those things hard to flesh out. But that's my general understanding. Yeah, I am confident in saying that. Just a frustration over like a larger role, more authority, in need of a promotion. Just I want more. You know, I want more out of this. Maybe that's to be the OC, be the pass game coordinator, hell, to be the head coach. I don't know. You can aspire for anything when your dad's the boss, right? Like, you eventually, that's just kind of how this whole thing works, right? Your dad leaves and you get the company. You know, this is America, you know, for the most part. So I can't specify what exactly Nate would want, but that was like something we were all very confident in. And I say we, like me, Jason, Mike, all very confident in putting in there that this guy wants more of a role and is willing to be like, man, screw this, I'm out. You know, if it was not delivered. And that's another thing that I think is really important to keep in mind. And this was really hard to report on the Shane Waldron thing. Like, that's why I never cared who the OC was. I know, like, I think I wrote a piece writing out names and people would ask me what I think about Shane and his press conference. And, we got the Rams offense now, so we're good. In my head, I'm like, guys, Shane's walking into a mess. You know, like, God bless. You know, like, imagine knowing the Nate thing. And then seeing the Shane thing is like, well, sure, like good luck, sir. Like, I don't think changing the OC mattered that much. And I think a lot of people probably can see why now, can agree that you can put any of us right here on this Zoom call can be the OC, right? But if part of our job is making Russ happy and part of our job is making Pete happy, and it's very hard to make both of them happy at the same time, like, you know, then it really, you know, it doesn't matter. So yeah, that's my understanding of the Nate thing. And I think it segues kind of into like why it never mattered really, whether it was Shane Waldron or Brian Schottenheimer or Pep Hamilton. Like, there were some guys I thought might be nice, but there's so many politics to the situation that this, the schemer is not the problem. You know, it doesn't, it's very clear that like there are some egos here and some pride involved in the power struggle in a way that's like, yeah, Shane, good luck, man. I don't know if you gave me your direct deposit info yet, but like, it's not too late. It's not too late to go back to Sean, you know, down there in LA if you want to, man. That's probably a lot less stress than what he's about to like take on right now.
Well, it's an interesting question. When you talk about Nate Carroll, is this basically like, we can extrapolate that this is Pete Carroll's child, right? That he's
and,
not listening
and to be
to.
Clear that one of the two people in the organization last year that Pete Carroll said he was hold him accountable was the guy.
Yeah.
Cool. Like that doesn't add up. Now they brought back Carl Smith Tater, who is another person he mentioned, but like that's, and when you dig down on the accountability aspect of it, that's a fascinating piece to me.
Yeah, no, is that what you're going to ask? Like that part of it?
Yeah.
Well, this is his child, though. Like, if he can't listen to Nate Carroll, how is he able to listen to Russell Wilson, right? Like, is this just something, this is a Pete Carroll issue, right? Across the board is what we're hearing. This isn't necessarily specifically about Russell Wilson. It's not specifically about Nate Carroll. There is a common thread between these two things.
Yeah, you know, and I don't necessarily know how well Nate and Pete communicate, whether he listens to him or not or whatever. I don't necessarily know that. But yeah, I do think the accountability part, you know, is really important, man. It's something, I mean, to be honest, this is not exactly the same, but it's kind of what Sherman and some of the defensive guys were trying to tell us a few years ago. Like, honestly, I went back and read for research on this story, the Seth Wickersham article from 2017 and then the Klemko and Greg Bishop one from the same year, I want to say. Like, you read those now and then go read ours and be like, wow. No, like, accountability is an underlying theme there. It's dressed up a little bit and there's some jabs being thrown. But for the most part, like, from Richard Sherman's view, he's not quoted in the Wickersham story, but, like, it's implied that he's involved in the narrative. It's like, guys, he person A does not hold person B accountable, and person B doesn't hold person A accountable, and it's just a mess, and we're on the defense and we're paying for it, essentially, right? Like, that was kind of the gist there. And you look and it's like, huh, okay, I can see that. You know, it's not, it's like, it's not just about Russell, and it's like not having a boss on Pete Carroll's part. And I don't think it's just not having a boss. It's like, he took this job to not have one. You know, you ask him why he came here from USC. I think our USC guy, I think it's like Antonio Morales or something like that. Our USC guy at The Athletic did like an oral history of Pete leaving USC and coming up to Seattle. And part of it was like, because I want to run things like I was in college. College football head coach is the most powerful dude on campus. They can't do nothing, you know, for the most part. Only people who can are the donors. And as we're running at the University of Texas, they loud. That's the only guy. So Pete basically has it structured like college, you know, and you see other people trying to structure it in a very similar way. I think Ron Rivera is trying to do something very similar over in Washington. I think you're gonna see other coaches try to do that too, because I mean, if no, you don't got an answer to nobody, that's kind of good. Then you just bring your kids on. But to the point about no one really holding them accountable in the building, like, I asked that question to get those four names out of Pete. And now I'm sure people can realize why I asked that question, because it was being like danced around behind the scenes. I was like, huh, maybe I should just see what Pete says, you know. And he gave four names. He gave Snyder, Brandon Carroll, Nate, and Tater. I was like, man, two, me and Chris talked about it on the podcast, like, we don't have kids, Chris and I don't, but if we worked for our fathers, we would not be the only people that our fathers listen to at the company. Right. There's just no way that, like, my dad's only listening to me, you know, like, that's just not how that's going to work. So I never really, like, I didn't have to do much digging after that. I was like, Pete just kind of spilled a lot of beans right there. Really only listen. You can only be told the truth by your kids. Someone who's not currently on the payroll, Tater wasn't at the time. And then Schneider was on the scouting side. Everyone there, you cut their checks for the most part. Like, you're above them. That's really, really dangerous. And when you're winning divisions once, you know, every couple of years, that it doesn't really matter. But this highlights that it actually does matter to a lot of guys in the building.
So your solution to fix these problems is outlined in your 12-step plan today, is to bring back Sherman.
You know, what's crazy is, and I didn't talk to Sherm. It may come across like that. I should have wrote that, but I can't just be like, I didn't hear this from Sherman, right? It's a weird line. So I didn't like talk to Sherm or anything, but the sense that I've gotten, and I've wondered this since he was hurt for the Niners, like, would he come back? would he come back? Because I never got the sense, and I learned a little bit of this reporting on the Earl Thomas story that me, Jenks, Sando, and our Baltimore writer, Jeff, did. There's not as much bad blood as you would think between the organization and some of those guys. Like Michael Bennett, for example, spoke to the team this summer on Zoom, like in August or something like that. But when everyone was talking about racism and policing, like you would never think that the way Michael Bennett exited, you know, like that he would be just cool with Pete to be like, hey man, I need you on the Zoom. All right, cool, Pete, I got you. You know, that's a good example of like, there's not as much bad blood as we thought. I think there actually is with Earl. I should clear that up. But, with like guys like Sherm, guys like Mike B, I don't think it's like, I can't be in the same room with you. I hate you. You know, stuff like that. I mean, even between Richard and Russell, I don't get a sense that like there's that animosity. Same thing with Mike B and Russell, or even Earl and Russell. I think Earl and Russell's wives are still tight, right? Like, so the reason that I was comfortable putting that in there, just in general, I think I said I get the sense neither side would be opposed. I really don't think there's a ton of bad blood between the Seahawks and any of the players that like kind of went out in the name of insubordination. And when you think about it, it makes sense. I don't think any of the NFL team has like the alumni network that like the Seahawks do, you know, in terms of bringing guys back. How many guys have just been brought, you know, Brandon Brown and Deshaun Shedd, Bruce Irvin, there's just a Byron Maxwell, Benson Mayoa, DeMarcus, they bring everybody back, you know, they'll give everybody a shot to run it back with you.
Oh, and Alex, I think Collins.
Alex Collins, Marshawn Lynch, Robert Turbin, like Luke Wilson came back 12 times, you know, like everybody comes, has a chance to a J.R. Sweezy, like guys just have a chance to come back. So the more I was like reporting on that, I was like, you know, that makes sense. I don't think that necessarily Russell and Sherm would be like in the same room again, just like beat each other up on the first day and then kind of move on. I think that that's something that if it was to happen, I don't know if it will, it wouldn't be the problem internally like it was before. I think part of that is because Sherm's on the tail end of his career, and he's just kind of grown a little bit, you know, since then too. Like he was like all pro prime Sherm, like, yo, I'm that dude. Like he still is that dude, but now is more closer to just riding off in the sunset, you know, with the team that drafted him.
Also, you watch Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard enough games, Russell Wilson starts to look a hell of a lot better now, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, oh man. Well, the other thing about guys like Sherman, even if KJ was to go somewhere in free agency, you want familiarity and winning. It mattered to you. Like the dollars and cents definitely matter. But like ring chasing in the NFL is not ring chasing in the NBA, right? Where it's like you sign with the Warriors and they have KD, you got a good shot, right? Or if you sign with LeBron James, you're probably going to go to the finals. I think that's been true like every year for like ever. NFL is different. You want to play for coaches, you know, schemes, you know, right? So if you're Sherm, you want to play for, you know, defensive coordinators, you know, you want to play when they're playing cover three, right? Just something that's comfortable for you. And you don't want to play on a team that sucks. So if you look at Sherm, he has free agency. Where's the defensive coordinators he's worked with? Saleh, Gus Bradley, Dan Quinn, Rashard. Like those are probably the options there. Like, who's on teams that suck? Okay, well, you're probably not going to go to the Raiders. Maybe Dallas. I think Rashard's in New Orleans. So, like, I think from Sherm's view, again, I haven't talked to him about this or anything, but, like, I'm just kind of connecting the dots. He's only going to go to a few places, like, that can offer familiarity and winning. And Seattle's one of them. So that's why I said, hey, man, just call him. If he hangs up, he hangs up. But, like, just call him and talk about it.
Do you think it makes sense when we're approaching this, and I suppose the Seahawks also, there are two drastically different ways this offseason can go. Which is, if we wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden Russell Wilson is traded to the New Orleans Saints or whatever, the team is totally different. Like, it's whether they want it to be or not, it's a rebuild. The team around them is not good enough outside of Russell Wilson. So do we just kind of approach this offseason as if everything will end up working out and be fine with Russell Wilson, and they do try to have these conversations about bringing back players like Sherman? Or do you try to hedge it a little bit and kind of go both ways and think about rebuilding at the same time? Or, you know, if you bring in somebody like Sherman, that's a win now decision. And everything that they've done to this point, the Jamal Adams trade, they're all win now decisions. Everything they've done has pointed to right now. And if Russell Wilson isn't there anymore, it's a total fucking waste, you know?
Yeah, you have to go all in on winning right now. No one's going to be here. And that with all the trade, like scenarios that I think shout out to Slickhawk at KJR. He has one like a 4-team trade or something like that. And I read it just because like I respect his opinion. And I think it has Seattle getting like 10 picks or something like that. I was like, okay, you're getting everyone fired in that scenario. Yeah. Pete and John aren't going to be here. You can't start the rebuild and here be here for the end when we get good again. No, you're getting fired in between. That's just kind of how this goes, right? You're going to have a season where you have a ton of picks and you're going to go like 4-12 and you're going to get canned, right? Like that's just how it goes. Or you go even worse. You're like 1-15 and you'll get like the number one overall. It'd be like the Jets, right? Like Adam Gase got canned, right? Like or whoever was a Jags coach, they got all their picks and all that money. Doesn't matter. You're out of here now. Now we're gonna start over with someone new. Pete's been fired. I don't know how many times in the NFL. He knows how this goes. He knows what getting fired looks like, right? Like that's he knows how it's coming, what it looks like in the media, when how they're talking about you, how you're perceived in the building, all that. You get rid of Russell Wilson and you don't get a quarterback in return, and you got to do the rebuild thing. Everybody's getting fired. Right? That's just how it goes. So I think that it's kind of like a survival thing right now. To like we have to win. You know, that's why I have my 12-step plan. The first thing is fix it with Russ. Give him what he wants. I really don't think Russ wants to sit there in the room with Mike Solari and John and go through right tackle free agency tape. I'm pretty sure he just wants to know the plan. I just, you know, Russell's too, like I say, swimming with sharks right now. He does not want to grind tape on like Taylor, I think Moten is his name from Carolina, and whoever else, Daryl Williams from Buffalo. Yeah, I'm not trying to grind tape on them. Just tell them you're interested in them. Probably like, all right. I have another name. Throw in, insert guy here. You guys should look at him too. All right, Russ, we'll look at him too. Come back. Hey, Russ, that was a good suggestion. Or come back. Hey, Russ, he stinks. He was playing with a bad knee last year. Probably not a good signing for us. Worth the money. All right, cool, guys. Thanks. You know, like, you know, just some type of communicate. I really don't think he needs that much to keep him off the Cowherd show. Like, I really don't think it's that. Like, it's probably worse than I'm playing it up as. But in terms of the control part and the say, the personnel thing is real simple. Tell them who you're going after, go after them, make sure they cost a lot of money. That's just kind of the thing. In terms of the offense, I think that part is the part that's going to be tricky because I don't believe – I know it might sound crazy. I don't want to assume that Shane Waldron is going to come up here and just run the Rams offense, even though he came from the Rams. There's literally nothing to suggest that that will be the case, right? He worked for McVay. He did what his boss said. That does not necessarily mean what's what he's going to do. You know, like that's like the same thing as assuming that Brian Schottenheimer is going to leave, go to Jacksonville and run Pete Carroll's offense. Why would he do that? Right. Just because he worked for, no, it's not really how it works. You do what the boss says, you know? So I think that Shane, a first time OC, is more likely to do what Pete wants than Russell wants. I know a lot of us have kind of talked ourselves into the fact that Shane's going to be this happy middle with this play action and stuff. And there will be some of that. I think Mike Sando made a good point. Russell will probably be under center a lot more, which makes the play action stuff a little better and just better for your run game too. In a lot of ways. Yeah, sure. It'd be some improvements, but like to assume that Shane, a first time play caller, a first time OC is going to come in here to the like most controlling man in the head coach in the NFL and just do what the quarterback wants. Come on guys. Like that's just, no, he's not going to do that. So that's my fear, if more than the personnel side, is that we get to week one and it's more Pete ball than it is Russ ball. And we all know how that'll go. Sure, they can win like 11 games or something like that. But them not being on the same page will ultimately lead to like a divisional loss in Green Bay again or Tampa or whatever. Like it doesn't end in a Super Bowl. And the only way to fix this thing right now is to get back to the Super Bowl, I think.
All right, I think that leads us to kind of wrapping this up. So on this podcast, we like to talk about in percentage chances of things instead of predictions, yes or no. Last week on this podcast, Tristan gave a 100% chance that Russell Wilson will be on the Seahawks in 2021. I said 95%. Where do you land on that probability?
Yeah, I'm about 95. I'm 95 there. I do think it's more like to light a fire what they're doing, like I said earlier, than just like we want out. And yeah, Russ not done. Like I said, he you get traded to New Orleans right now, you're probably just going to lose in the division around there too. You know, it's just kind of how it goes, you know, just be doing it in a place with like greasier food, you know, that's kind of it, and a better nightlife. So, I mean,
that sounded maybe a little disparaging of the New Orleans cuisine, which
I wanted to say better food, but I've never been to New Orleans. But everything I've gathered is that the food scene is way better than Seattle.
Seattle's good, but yeah, New Orleans is pretty great for.
Yeah, so I mean, that's yeah. I guess I should say yeah, not greasier, just better food. You're right. That's a better way. Even if I have not been there, so I do think yeah, I'm at like 95 that Russell is the quarterback in week one. Vegas has it as they've sent me the odds. It was like how'd they word it. It was like the chances that Russell takes the first snap of week one or 2021 or something like that. The odds are pretty bad. I wouldn't bet on that. I would throw a bunch of money on that. The answer is yes, that he takes the first snap.
I mean, that one's a bit more complicated because if, heaven forbid, there's some sort of situation where the backup quarterback is in, he could still be on the team and not.
Yeah, no, that's tricky. That's why I wanted to know the wording on it. Yeah. Vegas will get you, man. They'll get you.
Okay, but what about now? What are the percentage chances that Russell Wilson is the Seahawks quarterback in the 2022 season?
That's a lot lower. I would go way, way lower. I would go like 25, 30, I think. I just can't be super confident in it because I think Jody is really important here. And not even think I know. She's the owner of the damn team, right? She's very important. And I think if your hands off, like obviously Jerry Jones would be very comfortable tearing something down, right? It's because he does this, right? Like he's very involved. Like he goes on the radio. Like anyone, no one's even heard Jody's voice. So if I'm hands off, it is much easier to, as even though I know that is harder to find a quarterback, but if I'm a hands off person, it is much easier for me to just let Pete figure it out. You know, you found Russ, go find another Russ. I know it's not that simple, but I'm like, if I'm just sitting there, like, you know, on my couch, I'm like, yeah, I'm swimming in money. It's like, yo, hey, Joe, do we got a problem here? You got to choose between Pete and Russ. Like, it's not working. We done lost in the division round again. Like I say, it's March 2022. It's like, we lost again. You got to pick. What are we going to do? Well, if you're just trying to get this, the quickest solution as possible, it's okay. I pick Pete. Trade Russ wherever he wants to go. Get us a quarterback in return, whatever. Fix it, you know, do what we do before. Made the playoffs before, you know, we had Russell, do it again. I know that's, again, really simple, but I could see that being the move other than, like, tearing the whole thing down. Because also there's no guarantee that if you choose Russell that he even wants to stay at that point either, right? Like, let's say you hire the wrong person there too, and it's like, okay, well, you hired such and such, and I want to be enemy. So now I went out. It's like, well, damn. Now then you're just letting Russell run the show, right? Then you haven't chosen Russell over Pete. You've, like, just promoted Russell, which is like a dangerous game to be playing with your.
You've turned him into
your quarterback there. Yeah, exactly. Yes. And that's not. Russell may want that. I don't know if he does or not. That's a bad thing. You do not want that. And I mean that just from like a just. I don't know the word I want to use, but I don't want to make it seem like I'm on some like Rob McNair inmates running the prison thing. It's not that, but it is. There's something to the theme there of someone who's supposed to be in like the labor section elevating, you know, while still technically being, it's tricky. I don't want it. No one thinks I'm racist. It's fine. So you guys get what I'm trying to say. Like, I think that's bad. My point is like, if I'm Jody, I could see the simplest solution being I choose Pete, you know, someone I'm a little more familiar with. I'm really only replacing one player for the most part. You would change a bunch, but like I'm changing a player versus changing literally all of my coaches, all of my scouts, blah, blah, blah. Yep. That's a lot harder to do on the fly and still want to win as opposed to like, let's get a bunch of cap space and pick up Derek Carr. Like, does that suck? Yes. But that is a lot simpler to just press the button on from your couch without having to go out here and lead this search for a new, you know, culture. You need a whole new culture if you fire Pete. You need a whole new quarterback if you fire us. Yep.
Well, this is awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you also for leaving us with that visual of Eric Bieniemy and Russ being united one day.
That would be fun. I think so. It's tricky about head coaches though, man. You don't know who's a good head coach and who's not. Like, knowing offense does not make you a good head coach, right? Like, we could call it the Josh McDaniels rule, maybe. Like, you just not just knowing how to scheme is not it. Like, you got to be a leader of men. Guys want to be able to play for you. That's why we laugh at the dude the Eagles just hired. Like, you got to be able to give some speeches, dude. Like, you nervous when the cameras come on? Like, there's 100 grown men and they're dependent on you. Coaches and, you know, even equipment guys, players, like, you need to be able to like, galvanize the troops, you know? So, yeah, that would be fun with Russ and Bieniemy, but I'm even though I think he should get a try for a job, I think there's no guarantee that, like, because he's a genius schemer, that, like, he's a good leader of men. It goes for someone like Robert Saleh too, whoever, defensive guys, offensive guys, hell, even the dude at the Giants. Because, you know, special teams doesn't, I mean, just because you work with everyone, because special teams got to do, doesn't mean you'll be good at the working with everyone part head coach. It's very hard to figure out who's like the CEO type, you know, that is. But if things keep going this way, they're going to have to figure it out, because it's, I don't think Russ and Pete can coexist in 2022 on this like trajectory that we're on right now.
Well, that's a depressing note to go out on, but we're so glad to have you back, and I've appreciated all your coverage here.
Oh man, appreciate you guys. You guys actually got into the weeds of it. I like it. I like it. I did a bunch of hits like last week where there was like some really like surface level stuff, which makes sense. They don't even know me. People were getting my name wrong last week, but it's just like, you guys know, you guys are immersed in the, you know, Seahawks world. So it's a lot more fun conversation. So that's dope. Appreciate you guys.
Such a good conversation. Freaking love, we have got to have Mike Sean on more. Honestly, we should consider replacing you.
Oh, me? I'm the one you're replacing?
Oh, man.
Well, I don't know if we will know which one of us still has the name Pelton.
I guess that is true. No, Mike Sean already has, as he mentioned a couple of times, a very awesome podcast called Seahawks Man to Man, which you should definitely listen to for more in-depth. Well, I guess maybe not more in-depth than this conversation, which was quite in-depth, but further conversation on the ongoing Russell Wilson issue. Curious if you had any other takeaways from that conversation, because I think there was a lot that Mike Sean brought up that I hadn't necessarily considered before this, especially a couple things which stood out to me was the symbiotic relationship between Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll, and really just how much more Pete Carroll needs Russell Wilson than Russell Wilson needs Pete Carroll for his future as coach of the Seattle Seahawks and his ongoing success as coach of the Seattle Seahawks. He can't turn around and trade Russell Wilson for a quarterback who's just as good as Russell Wilson. And I think that Pete Carroll is keenly aware of that information. And though he may be frustrated with Russell Wilson right now and vice versa, I think that they need to figure it out. Pete in particular needs to figure it out for the future of his head coaching football life. This is also it for Pete Carroll. And I think we really saw it this last year with Belichick and Brady. And we saw Bill Belichick missing the playoffs and Tom Brady winning the Super Bowl. And don't think Pete wasn't aware of that. And also don't think that Russell Wilson wasn't aware of that as he sat at the Super Bowl watching that game, that the legendary quarterback moved on from his long-term head coach and was there hoisting the Lombardi trophy and the head coach wasn't in the playoffs. Like the relationship doesn't work both ways. And I think Pete has to figure it out, and that's why Russell Wilson will be on the Seahawks next year. Also, just understanding that we haven't gotten to scorched earth territory. This isn't Deshaun Watson. I'm not even willing to talk to the head coach territory. And also, I don't think that anything the Seahawks have done has warranted that either, in the same way that, you know, Deshaun Watson has been treated in Houston. So I think that was one of my biggest takeaways from that conversation, was at least for next season, Pete just has to figure out a way to make this work, whether he wants to or not.
I mean, I think I really wanted to drill down on what Russell Wilson wants. And, you know, it's the same thing where it doesn't look like a trade is what he wants, even if he's willing to accept a trade at this point because of the frustration with the situation. So that also, again, points to the same thing, which is we're going to try it in 2001 and everybody's going to cross their fingers that Shane Waldron solves all the problems.
It's all
you can make everyone happy. Good luck.
The not to get fast and furious about this, but it all comes back to family too.
Oh,
when Mike Sean was talking about you're drinking a Corona, right? But when Mike Sean was talking about Richard Sherman still having a good relationship with the team, with Michael Bennett still having a good relationship with the team, Pete Carroll, there is good to Pete Carroll. And again, though we may be frustrated with Pete Carroll, Pete Carroll has been the most successful coach in Seahawks history. Pete Carroll's consistently won with the Seahawks. If he had no redeeming qualities, if Pete Carroll was an amorphous blob of wanting to run the ball, He would
look,
not.
Look, we've seen Pete Carroll shirtless. Pete Carroll is not an amorphous blob, especially not in comparison to the vast majority of NFL head coaches.
But, right, you understand what I'm saying? Like, there are a lot of coaches who want to run the ball. And yes, those coaches aren't the, haven't won a Super Bowl and aren't the coach of a very, very good team for over a decade that has missed the playoffs one time since they drafted Russell Wilson and has never had a losing record after the first season as head coach.
But like, but also the other thing is the that came up in that conversation is that guys keep coming back to Seattle.
And that's,
you wouldn't
that's
be willing to keep
family.
Coming back if there wasn't something special here. And I think something special that if you only played in Seattle, you might take that for granted a little bit. And then you go somewhere else and find out that shit isn't like this everywhere. You start to appreciate, I think, it more in many ways.
But also vice versa. I think about this as Russell Wilson is like Pete Carroll's child in a lot of ways. Pete Carroll and all of these players.
So he's also frustrated with his role.
He's seen these players. It's hard to change your perspective of people. If you have a long-term boss without changing jobs, it's really hard to change your perspective about people. Even as they've grown from rookie third-round draft pick quarterback who has to prove themselves, who says all the right things along the way, who brings you a Super Bowl you're so proud. Russell Wilson is now a superstar quarterback. Like, we can see that Russell Wilson has changed. Pete Carroll might not be able to see how Russell Wilson has changed. And it feels like he is this. I'm getting too far with this because we don't know any of this, but it really feels like he is the father who everybody likes and they really want to be let in and they want his affection. And he can only get so far. And if you leave, everybody loves Pete Carroll, right? These players love Pete Carroll. They're willing to come back. Even when you're frustrated with Pete Carroll, you love him on a personal level. And that's what Pete Carroll is truly great at.
I was also glad that Mike Shean got into the aspect of them not valuing Russell Wilson's football perspective. Because that was something I was going to specifically ask about. That's like when you hear about the anecdote about the meeting before the Arizona game where he walked out of, that's what it sounds like, is his perspective is just not being valued by the team. And I do think that probably relates back to that element of still seeing him as this guy who, you know, you nurtured basically as a coach from the point they were a rookie, and not recognizing that now he's at a point where he's going to be more vocal and he deserves to be more involved in that process.
Mm-hmm. So
you still love your dad, even though his ideas are a little bit out of touch. You know, look, things have passed him by a little bit. You still want that approval from him, even though he's aged out. And look, he's not changing his mind about the run game. Let's be clear here. You can fight with him all you want. You can have every single fight with it. Look, I do it with Jan all the time.
I was wondering if that was going to come up.
Nothing is changing that perspective. And you can fight over and over and over again about things, but it's not changing at this point. And Pete Carroll views football one way, and I don't think, and that's what made me, the Shane Waldron stuff was like, would you like a wet blanket? Because it was like, Shane Waldron is probably not going to fix everything, which also, like, and when Mike Shean was like, is a first-time offensive coordinator, it's like, it's absurd that we think that a first-time offensive coordinator who's the quarterback coach for the Los Angeles Rams, quarterback coaching Jared Goff, is going to come in and be the solution to this franchise that has had ongoing interpersonal issues, much like a large family, for 6 years at least. And Shane Waldron, maybe even more. Shane Waldron is going to come in and be,
I don't know,
like,
if you remember the Percy Harvin era. They've been ongoing forever.
It really has been. It's been so, I mean, it's consistent.
The thing about the Seahawks and any NFL team, it's a really big family when there's 53 players and all the coaches. Like, that's, there's always going to be some uncle who's saying something he shouldn't. I was going to say, though, in your analogy here, we know that he's Dad Russ. We know that he's got children of his own. I think at this point, we got to say, acknowledge, it's Grandpa Pete.
Grandpa Pete, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's age appropriate.
Yep. I mean, I really think, but it's frustrating because you can't, Pete Carroll has redeeming qualities. And I think that that is a huge part of it. Pete Carroll does so much well. And there's almost no coach who does everything well. It's like, You're gonna have zero COVID cases on your team throughout the entire season, but also you're gonna run the ball more than you can, and it's like you're gonna have players really love them and want to play for them, but you're gonna run the ball way more than you should.
I mean, I think this comes back to the entire question about whether we want Pete Carroll to continue as the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks. And I simultaneously think that Pete Carroll is an above average NFL coach, and more than half of the teams in the league would upgrade if he became their head coach tomorrow. And that the average replacement coach the Seahawks would hire has a better chance of succeeding with Russell Wilson than he does.
Average coach? We went through this already, though. We went through all the coaches that were hired.
But I just think if the Seahawks were to hire someone more offensive-minded, it would be a better fit because they have a superstar quarterback.
No shit, but there's no guarantee that they would. And I think that's the part that we're missing is, again, how many of the coaches around the NFL do we actually think would be better than Pete Carroll? Now, not alienating Russell Wilson is a huge deal, but yeah, also there's a lot of coaches who could alienate Russell Wilson. Losing,
but at the
also
very least, you'd be
Russell
starting
Wilson.
Fresh, and then it might be time for that. Now, hopefully,
no,
it's not,
I mean,
but maybe after 2021, it will.
You would love for Pete to have some sort of honorary role within the organization, you know, something where he was a little bit less hands-on on the field. But I do
Chris
think
Peterson's role within the UW athletic department for Pete Carroll.
Yeah, maybe a little bit more hands-on than that. But fair. For all the Matt LaFleurs and Sean McVays, I think that they're also out there. They're Joe Judges and they're
Dan Campbell's.
I mean, we don't know about Dan Campbell. They're Adam Gase's, right? Adam Gase is an offensive-minded coach. Like,
I'm not saying that you could hire literally any offensive-minded coach. We're talking about Eric Bieniemy. Let's be real here. We're talking about Eric Bieniemy.
I mean, of course. Look, we understand. But even, you know, Mike Shaun, again, he brought out the wet blanket that he offered at first, and he was like, it's still wet if you want it again. And there's no guarantee that Eric Bieniemy would be a good NFL head coach. I think there's a very high likelihood that Eric Bieniemy would be a good NFL head coach. But, I mean, Kyle Shanahan has had one winning season as an NFL head coach. Is that right?
But he hasn't had Russell Wilson as his quarterback. That's the fundamental thing that I think I come back to. There's a floor to how good your team can be with a healthy Russell Wilson.
I don't know. It's an interesting conversation. The whole thing is an interesting conversation, but there are no guarantees in football, and we want to look at it like if we could just all of a sudden flip Pete Carroll for Sean McVay, for Kyle Shanahan, for Matt LaFleur, for Eric Bieniemy, of course! But that's not a guarantee. That's four coaches.
Well, there are also no guarantees in fried chicken.
There we go.
And it's time to return to our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, which did not take us, sadly, to Soto Chicken last week because it's closed on Sundays and you were too busy to get there on Saturday. So instead...
Too busy.
Well, like you had other plans. Fine.
I just did other things. Busy wouldn't be the way I'd describe it.
Fair. Instead, we went to Cookies Country Chicken, which we went to over the summer. The origin story here, to remind everyone, Brian Chandler, the chef, aka Cookie, is a Hood Canal native who ended up in Louisiana as a cook for oil industry crews. Part of the deal there was Sunday fried chicken dinners, allowing him to perfect his technique, which he started in the Seattle area as Cookies with pop-ups at Good Day Donuts in White Center before opening a more permanent pop-up, first at Sneaky Tiki in Georgetown, which is where they were located when we last had them, and now at Quality Athletics in Pioneer Square.
Wow. So, what kind of scenario leads you to work on an oil industry crew right outside of Delacroix? Like,
I feel like this might be a Seattle Chef Series question.
That is... oil industry crews,
yeah,
in Louisiana. That is like... how do you get here? Well, that's an interesting way to come upon fried chicken, I have to say.
I mean, I think he was aware of it previously. That was just when he started cooking it. So what do you recall from when he went there over the summer?
Not thinking it was good.
But you had it in one of these bad takeout situations, right? Where it was hours after the fact.
I think you and Katie were talking about it on the chat and I wasn't paying attention. And then Katie was like, I have food for you. And I rolled up, which I didn't even say that I wanted it. I rolled up to Katie's house. This was maybe July or August or something. Rolled up to Katie's house. I got whatever Katie had chosen to get and I ate it. And I was like, I don't get it. I do not get the hype.
Of which there is a lot. Like this was a Jan recommendation passed along after they were in the Seattle Times. I think I saw that as well, but she specifically did based off our Uncle Bob also emailing about it.
Bob.
Yeah. Bob was involved.
Okay.
So this time we split chicken strips, which you got Nashville style, 2-star spice, correct?
Yes.
Or level 2. And each of us then had a chicken breast and I ended up with all the sides, the fries and the mac and cheese, which obviously not part of this competition, but what did you think this time around?
Okay. I referenced Tangled Up in Blue a second ago, and much like how Bob Dylan recorded Blood on the Tracks, right? He did it hi-fi and he played it for a friend of his. I can't remember who it was, so I think somebody famous, and the person said to him, go back again. Make the record the demos. That's the record right there. Start over again. Much like that, we went back to Cookies Country Chicken. Is that what it's called?
That it is.
This is the best chicken in Seattle.
Wow! You've called off the search.
Shocked if there was somebody who beat this. It is like, this was not only the best chicken in Seattle, this was the best fried chicken I have ever had in my entire life.
Wow! You think it was that clear? Can you unpack it? Can you expand on that?
Okay, so a couple of things. They call them half, what is the exact word for the chicken breast when you get the fried chicken?
I don't know.
They split the chicken breast. It's not a full chicken breast. So there's a little bit less white meat there. They're a little bit smaller. I open up the box. I was excited about this. And I actually told Jan while I was driving over to pick it up, because she was yelling at me about not getting any for her. Thank you for that. And I was like, I feel like we'll be back there soon. Oh. I had a good feeling about it going in. Called up Cookie, ordered the food, talking to him. I was like, I'm getting really good vibes about this situation. Especially when I ordered the chicken strips, which my only issue is that they call them tendies on the menu. Which I think I might've complained about over the summer. They're
sure sounds like the thing you would have complained about.
Their strips
about.
Are tenders. Tendies, come on. Like, no self-respecting person says, I'm going to order chicken tendies. Sorry. But I was like, can I get the chicken tenders? I think I said strips. And I definitely, the word tendies did not come out of my mouth until now.
All right. That's noted for the record. Thanks.
But, and so he's like, great, got it. And I was like, but hold on a second. Do you have spicy or regular? Right? Tell me a little bit more here. You know what I mean? Like, we're at the point of this chicken search that I know to ask the question. All right. We know what we want. We know that.
You weren't previously aware that spicy or regular were options.
But he didn't ask. And they're not on the menu as far as I can tell. I don't believe that it mentions anywhere on the menu spice level. And Cookie said to me, yeah, I can do Nashville style, like 1 to 5. And I was like, oh, hello.
I'm also not sure you talked to Cookie for the record.
I talked to Cookie. Not sure. But he said, I can do. And nobody else talks like that. Unless he has a Southern person working there. I don't know.
And the guy is, I told you earlier, he's not from the South.
Look, he's
worked in Louisiana.
On those fishing boats outside of Delacroix. Look, you pick up an accent. It's an adopted thing.
Sure.
Okay, Bob Dylan's from Minnesota, but recorded a number of country albums. Has a song with Johnny Cash. Anyway, His name's not even Bob Dylan.
What?
Yeah. Robert Zimmerman recorded a country album with Johnny Cash in Nashville.
They have the Nashville style is a sandwich, hot chicken sandwich.
But he said, I can do it. That's not there. I mean,
it must
menu.
Be. But I think you may have ordered that off menu because you asked for it.
Fucking give me more. Right. You just said the two best words in the English language off menu. And he was like, yeah, I can do it. Nashville style. 1 to 5. And I was like,
I believe it's default are the two sweetest words in the English language.
When somebody says Nashville style, you get a little scared. For the record, at least I do. When it comes to chicken, I'm like, we're going to, and I also knew Mrs. Fantasy Genius was me having some too. I was like, look, we're in pleasant company here. Let's do a two. And so I was excited about that. I opened it up and I was like, I'm going to do the fried chicken breast first. I chose the smaller one because Mrs. Fantasy Genius was going to take less of the chicken strips. And I think in the half pound, there are 4 chicken strips, but they were big. And I bit into it. And I was like, the first bite that I had, the breading was perfect. It was soft but crunchy and flavorful. It fell apart just enough, and the chicken was dripping. It was just like, that's it. I had the first bite, and then I ate it with glee. Like it was the best fried chicken experience I have ever had. Eating chicken off the bone where it is dripping wet. And I fucking ravaged that thing like wild dogs. I like got into it. Every bit of breading. I'm like driving along Des Moines Way, veering into oncoming traffic. I didn't care.
Please drive safely.
As long as I had that cookies chicken, look, I was done. If I died, I would have been fine. Right? Send me to heaven with that cookies chicken in my mouth because it was the perfect fried chicken experience. And then I had one of the hot tenders. I was like, it has the right amount of heat. It's red, right? That's what you want it to look like. You want it to be red.
And you do want that, yes.
It was spicy, but it wasn't ridiculously spicy. It was like a one Modelo spice where you don't, because sometimes the Nashville hot chicken can just be, it'll taste good, but it is so hot that it almost distracts from the flavor of it. It kept all the juices inside and had the heat on the outside and the crunch. I literally, and all the sauces were perfect too. Every single sauce I got, the honey, I fucking love honey mustard. You get a honey mustard, the barbecue sauce was great. It was the perfect chicken experience. I wanted it the next day.
So are you rating this 100 then?
I want to leave room for something to beat it. So I'm going to give it a 97, but I think it would be very difficult. I don't think I could enjoy eating chicken. This was the most that I have ever enjoyed eating fried chicken in my entire life. So I don't know how I could enjoy eating fried chicken more, but.
Do you think this is better than Screen Door fried chicken?
Absolutely. It is better than Screen Door fried chicken. It's been a very long time. I will say it's been a long time since I've had Screen Door fried chicken, but Screen Door they do chicken. It's almost like a big, it's like a chicken strip that looks like a chicken breast.
What brunch, it's a breast pounded flat, so it's like a giant chicken strip. But at dinner, they do serve actual fried chicken.
I don't know if I've ever had that.
I don't think you have, no. I know all of the meals you've eaten.
You've been there every time I've been to Screen Door, so.
Yes, and I've been there for dinner, and you were not there.
I know all the meals you've eaten.
Let's remember some Tristan meals. Let's revisit some Tristan meals.
Okay, what did you think? I mean, I'm out here giving this chicken praise. Am I wrong? Right? Am I off base here? I ate it and I was just like, I fucking need to talk about this chicken right now.
You did call me and say that. I didn't feel as strongly about it as you did. I thought it was the best chicken we've had so far during this search.
Okay.
I don't know if I found it quite as the chicken breast quite as juicy, and I only
dripped. It dripped out. I took a bite, and maybe I just got the magical piece of chicken.
You might have gotten a better piece of chicken.
I only had one strip. Small. It's like you watch Carmelo Anthony play tonight. You would think he was the best player in the NBA.
Plays his franchise record for threes. We're not going to talk about it in the NBA Seattle update, but there's the reference. I only had one of the strips. I mean, I'm more of a strip person than I am a bone-in fried chicken person, so I would like to try more of the strips next time.
I'm down to go whenever. You see a fucking time, I'll drive to Pioneer Square for the chicken.
Wow.
This was the first chicken where I was like, every other one I've been like, it's been really good. But I feel like we hit this. I told this to you before. I feel like we hit this chicken at the exact right time, which was there was a bar set, and I thought that bar was pretty high, and I didn't realize how much higher it could go.
Okay.
If this would have been the first fried chicken we had, I think it would have thrown things off almost, because I think we would have rated it lower because we were waiting for something. And I'm down. We haven't been to June, baby. We haven't had that fried chicken. And I guess you have the All-Star game on Sunday, right?
I do.
Let's have a conversation, because I feel like when we're fresh off of this cookies chicken, I feel like it's time.
There was actually one that maybe we could try on Saturday that I saw a photo of, and I was like, this looks like the kind of chicken I'm really interested in.
What is that?
It's called Frank's Oyster House and Champagne Parlor.
Where's that at?
It is right near the Duchess.
There's no sex in Frank's Oyster House and Champagne Parlor.
No, I would hope not. Please no. I don't know if there's any cornbread. I thought it was the best that we've had. I didn't think it was as otherworldly as an experience as you did. I did not think it was the best fried chicken I've had in my life. I rated it a 90, but I do want to come in praise of, you know what I did think?
What was that?
It was the best fries I've had all of quarantine.
Holy shit.
They changed the fries since we last went. This was, I think, a relatively recent development. They used to have waffle fries, and they instead changed to beer battered traditional fries, and they held up and were still super crispy like a half hour later. And that is the biggest challenge, because fries are a food that does not travel well for takeout during a pandemic.
Oh yeah, you got to eat the fries in the car while you're driving.
I reheated them. I heated them up a little bit in the microwave just from a temperature standpoint.
I ate all the food before I even got to I-5. I ate all of it. I'm like,
I mean, that's after I was eating it. I still put sauces. It in the microwave.
I'm like opening up dipping sauces. I'm merging or whatever. And I'm just like, boop. Oh my God.
Please don't get in a crash because of chicken.
Dodge, for this chicken, it's worth it.
Oh boy.
I was blown away by the experience.
Well, that's exciting. I mean, it's good to have a front runner.
This is what food is really all about. And I have to say, food is always good. And the foods, I
food
feel
is
like,
not always good. Sometimes it's Jan's barbecue and hamburgers.
I feel like, look, apparently we don't stand for Jan's slander on this podcast.
Oh no.
I feel like I eat fairly good foods often, right? Not necessarily like the fanciest foods, but I feel like I eat, whether I'm cooking it, whether I'm eating it out, whether it's Taco Bell, like I feel like I'm eating pretty well. And
you care about what you're eating.
Every once in a while there is a food that you eat where you're just like, oh fuck, this stands out from everything else. And I think of it the same way as when I'm listening to new music, right? Like, you listen to so much new music and you're like, at some point, all music is just, it's good or it's fine or whatever. And sometimes you hear one thing and you're like, that's the thing. You're like, this thing stood out. There's masses of all this other stuff, but this one thing stood out from everything else. That's how you know it's special. And that was my perspective about Cookies Country Chicken.
Well, that's as high a review as you can get, I think. Higher rating, highest review. Should we talk about other Seattle food?
I'm
You're excited just remembering this meal?
I want to eat the chicken again.
Perhaps soon. Exciting news for the inside folks is Dick's Drive-In is set to open its first Eastside location in decades at Bellevue's Crossroads Shopping Center will be the eighth location for Dick's, which most recently expanded to Kent. Hope is to have it open by the end of the year.
Dick's. I'm out here every week. I'm getting more and more aggressive about it. I'm telling people, move to Renton. It is right there waiting. There is nothing else. There's nobody else here. There's not a Little Woody's in Renton, right? There's nothing else that you're competing with in Renton. There are no local chains in Renton aside from Azell's. And it is sitting there waiting, and nobody will go there. Everybody is scared. Crossroads? Have you been to Crossroads?
Don't think so. Maybe
really
once.
You've never been to Crossroads?
Once or twice, maybe.
Holy unpleasant experience. Move to Renton, Dix. What is it? It's like a maybe closed movie theater. Maybe there was a JCPenney's there. Also, we definitely went to. Isn't that the mall that we went to the dumpling place at?
No, that's not Crossroads.
You sure?
Yes.
Oh, maybe Crossroads is
that's
a little
Factoria,
bit deeper.
That's Factoria.
Maybe Crossroads is a little bit deeper in Bellevue.
I for sure have been to Factoria many a time, good sir.
I think Crossroads is every time I'm like Mrs. Fantasy Genius. I'm like, oh, this isn't Crossroads, and I'm like, that's the one where the Target is at, right? And she's like, no.
I mean, who knows? There may be a Target there. I don't know.
No, it's all Factoria. Everything that I'm thinking of is Factoria. I'm like, does it come up in an Almost Live sketch?
Factoria.
But no, I think Crossroads is a little bit deeper, and it's by where they do the Bellevue, the like summer festival. Did you go to that with us? Where they had the sad ponies tied up?
No. I don't know anything about this.
Holy depressing experience. I'm pretty sure that's where it is. Look, there's a Jersey Mike's nearby. Like, come on. Come on, Dix. Renton is there waiting. It is the perfect neighborhood to have moved into, and you're going to be in fucking Crossroads, right? Renton has nothing near it. Nothing. You would have lines for miles in downtown Renton waiting for you.
I mean, the good news about Dix is they can go anywhere and have lines for miles. That's the thing about them. Staying on the burger theme, after Monica Demas on that podcast mentioned the Smarty Pants Garage Burger was better than Loretta's, the best, as she described it, flat burger.
That was bold.
In Seattle. Had to go try it out. So I went for lunch today. And I got to say, it might be better than Loretta's.
Wow.
It was a very flavorful burger. The cheese... Like there's maybe a little more flavor in the burger patty than you would get at Loretta's. The cheese was perfectly melted. It beat my expectations. And the sauce, I thought at first it might not have enough sauce, but it's like kind of a horseradish sauce, apparently, horseradish base. So there's like a little bit of a kick there, enough of a kick that distinguishes it from a burger like Loretta's. And all told, I don't know. I mean, it's been a while since I've been to Loretta's. I may be there soon for comparison, and I will report back as soon as I do. But it's certainly a worthy competitor and something you need to check out.
How much is the Smarty Pants burger?
It's like $10.50, but it comes with fries.
Okay, so it's a higher price point than Loretta's.
It is, yes.
I still think it's really tough, and I think that there can be. We talked about this with Loretta's. There can be better, and Smarty Pants is a bar that I know a lot of people like.
They don't serve it at the location in Georgetown. I've done extensive research on this now.
All right.
Only at the Burien location.
I was going to say, because I feel like I've been there and I've never had this burger before.
I definitely been to Smarty Pants to have a sandwich at one point.
Okay, so this is a Burien specific issue.
It is, yes.
Wow.
Which I hate to not know about something exciting in seemingly my own backyard.
They could have moved to Renton, and they decided to move to Burien.
Well,
No, this is interesting news, though. But I do feel like the reason that the tavern burger on its own, you're getting it to go or whatever, still amazing. But when you hit Loretta's at the right time, whether you're inside or you're outside on the patio, even better. There's really no better experience when you factor in the combination of you're drinking an Oli. You're eating a tavern burger. You're there with friends. It is a really tough experience to beat.
And presumably by the right time, you mean not during a pandemic.
That we're talking, look, we went there pre-pandemic numerous times. Like, it's not
obviously.
Like, we know what it's like, right? You're sitting in an Airstream trailer, and maybe that'll reopen post-pandemic. Anything's possible.
The Gulf Stream, which is long, who knows where it is now, it's even more horrifying in a pandemic context. He was troubling previously.
Just like a COVID hot box.
Oh, no. A lot of aerosolization going on in there.
But the whole experience, it's a very hard experience to beat. And I think that elevates the Tavern Burger from really great to the best burger in Seattle.
Sure. Completely fair. Should we get back to Seattle sports?
I just want to talk about chicken more.
Want to continue raving. The Sounders have announced their preseason schedule, which will mostly stay local in contrast to...
Skipping by my Mariners hot takes.
Did you have them? More Kevin Mather talk?
Was there any additional fallout? Or the Mariners?
No, because then the Russell Wilson story happened and it like completely was gone from the news cycle. It was like 72 solid hours of this is the biggest news that has ever happened in Seattle. And then it's Russell Wilson might leave. Sounders announced their preseason schedule, which will mostly stay local. In contrast to past years, they will face the Tacoma Defiance on March 25th and host the Portland Timbers on March 30th in exhibitions before traveling to LA from April 6th through 11th, where they'll face LA Galaxy twice and fellow USL side San Diego Loyal SC.
I kind of had the feeling this weekend of, you know, you have the spring feeling starting to creep in, right?
I mean, it was 1 year from the first Sounders MLS matches today, Chris Smith, Talking Taco Time co-host, posted about.
It really felt like this weekend. It was a little bit sunny, right?
Oh, I mean, today it was like, it got up to almost 60.
The sun is up later than it previously was. And I really started feeling like, I feel like soccer, like Sounders soccer should be coming back right about now. So we've still got quite a while to wait.
It's a much later start to the season than years past because of the pandemic. A bit of additional Storm news besides the Sue Bird re-signing. New Storm forward Katie Lou Samuelson was named to the USA Basketball 3x3 women's team for the FIBA Olympic qualifying tournament in May in Austria, which will likely take her away from the Storm for part of this regular season. We still haven't seen a schedule for the WNBA yet. Roster for the 3x3-on-3 team also includes former UW star Kelsey Plum, along with Stephanie Dolson and Alicia Gray. The top three finishers from that 20-team tournament will qualify for the Olympics. Which 3x3-on-3 women's, both men's and women's, it's now an Olympic sport. UW softball, the Huskies suffered their second loss on Friday at San Diego State, losing 4-0. They won the two other games versus the Aztecs and swept a doubleheader at USD on Sunday, moving to 13-2 this season. They'll head this weekend to Honolulu for a three-game series against Hawaii.
Wow, that would be really nice in any other circumstance.
Sure would, yes. Still probably nice to be there weather-wise. Kelly Lynch has started both UW losses, going 3-2 so far with a 3.36 ERA. Gabby Plain remains unbeaten at 7-0 with a 0.52 ERA.
Now, normally this would be hyperbole or a joke to say. In any other context outside of softball, why don't they just start Gabby Plain every single game?
I mean, she'll start all the important games for sure, but they definitely need a reliable second starter. So you'd like to see Kelly Lynch pitch a bit better than she has thus far. The Huskies dropped to 6th in the ESPN.com USA Softball Top 25 last week. This week's rankings after that second loss, not yet out. UW women's basketball wrapped up the regular season with a 61-52 loss Sunday at Washington State. Finished 3-12 in the Pac-12 and seeded 11th entering the Pac-12 tournament. They'll face number 6 seed Colorado on Wednesday at 8 p.m., The Buffaloes swept the season series, but both matchups were competitive, including a 55-50 final on senior day at UW. UW men's basketball also wrapped up the regular season last weekend. An 80-72 loss on Thursday at Arizona State, much more competitive than the previous matchup in that set. And then on Saturday, a 75-74 loss at Arizona that came down to the final seconds.
Wow.
Quad Green's desperation three came up just short at the buzzer, or well short at the buzzer, I guess I should say, after Ajulis Tabellis hit the go-ahead jumper for Arizona with 5.2 seconds remaining.
This was the national TV game.
Yes, this was on CBS. The Huskies actually gave the national audience, it looked pretty rough in the first half where neither team could make a shot, but they gave the national audience a thrilling game after I tweeted about how they should not be on national TV.
I mean,
it still shouldn't, yes, logically. In what will apparently be his final regular season game at UW, Hamir Wright had a career-high 18 points in that one before fouling out. The Huskies are off this week, along with four other Pac-12 teams, in preparation for the start of the conference tournament March 10th in Las Vegas. So we'll find out this weekend where the Huskies will... I think they can only be seeded 11th or 10th at this point, but we'll see who they're going to actually play.
Does that give them... So they're playing in the first round.
Yes.
And you do. Are there a couple of teams that they would likely to be playing, or...?
It's the Pac-12. It's all over the map.
Oh, God.
I think Arizona State might be their projected matchup at the moment, but I could be misremembering that.
Is it naive to say, are we within, so you're telling me there's a chance territory?
No.
Okay.
That is naive. Arizona State, Utah, and Washington State appear to be in the mix, although it's unclear whether Washington State is going to be able to play. They had a COVID-19 pause that scuttled their scheduled game on Monday night against Arizona. So we'll see on that one. Might be down to 10 teams. Might be actually be a Pac-10 tournament once again.
I've been saying bring back the Pac-10. So.
Speaking of the Pac-10, let's revisit 2003-04 when the Huskies took a trip to the desert, same as this past weekend. It was a big game on Thursday of that weekend versus Arizona. The Huskies had beaten just two top 100 teams in their streak of 8 Pac-12 wins in 9 games, both of those wins coming at home against Arizona and Oregon. So they still needed to prove they could beat a good team on the road. And they got that opportunity against a Wildcats team playing without leading scorer Salim Spadademeyer, who was suspended by Coach Lute Olson, quote, for failure to meet team responsibilities. Fellow starting guard Mustafa Shakur was limited to 21 minutes by foul trouble, forcing Olsen deep into his relatively weak bench. The deeper Huskies had a 39-9 edge in bench scoring, including a team-high 22 points from Trey Simmons. They led by as many as 10 points in Tucson and were up 87-84 in the late stages when Channing Frye went for a 2 instead of a tying 3. He missed, and UW completed the 89-84 win to move into sole possession of second in the Pac-12, just their second win in the past 20 trips to the McHale Center. Lorenzo Romar called it, quote, the biggest win of the year.
At the time.
At the time, yes.
Wow.
It'd be weird if... Yeah. I should remember this game. There was no Sonics game opposite. I must have watched it. I don't remember it at all.
Salim Stoudemire was suspended. Man, we freaking loved Salim Stoudemire. Maybe it was the next year. The next year was the year that Illinois was a 1 seed, right? Or was that?
No, that was the next year, yeah.
When it was like Illinois, Arizona. This was a little bit early for Greg Oden's Ohio State, right?
This is very early for, or a couple years early for Greg Oden's Ohio State. Yes.
That is fascinating, though. So it was a slightly younger Salim Stoudemire. He hadn't quite come into his own.
But I mean, he was leading the conference in scoring. But yes, it was not his senior year. That was the next year when, as you're recalling, yes, they lost in the Elite Eight to Illinois, which was it? Were they still undefeated at the time? They had lost one game. They went 29-1 in the regular season. They were 35-1 entering that game. And then 90-89 overtime win. I believe that was in Chicago, although that's not on the KenPom page. In the Elite Eight over that Arizona team that was a 3 seed.
So this was a monster victory for the Huskies at the time. And really, this was the one that proved that it was real.
Yeah. Like, it was exciting that they beat Arizona at home. But every once in a while, you'd beat good teams at home in this era. You'd pull the upset. The Pac-10 was still the Pac-10 at that point. It still had its share of surprising outcomes.
God, freaking Trey Simmons. What would we give to just have one Trey Simmons right now?
Oh.
Oh.
It would be pretty great. There's not a single Green River Community College transfer on this year's team.
That's a shame, I think. or Highland Community College.
Hey, you saw my tweet earlier, right?
No, what you're out here referencing Highland Community College?
It was an old Des Moines edition of the Low Post last Friday. Because it was Brian Scalabrini was the first guest. Highland Community College's greatest. No, I guess they're just going by Highland College now.
Are you counting yourself?
I'm going, well, not for Highline, but I'm counting myself for Des Moines since I was going to Mount Rainier at the same time that Scal was playing for Highline.
Wow.
So every Low Post guest on last Friday was within about a 5 mile radius back in 1997-98.
Zach Lowe was nowhere to be seen.
not new.
He wasn't out there taking pickleball with me at Highline College, now college. He was teaching it. It really feels like a player like Trey Simmons at the time. I think we loved Trey Simmons, but really took him for granted, I think, in a lot of ways. Whereas, like, you just felt like you could always find a player like Trey Simmons. And we've learned over this last decade that is not the case.
I don't know if you could necessarily felt like you could always find him. It's just like there were four NBA stars on that team, four NBA players. Like two guys who enjoyed, you know, one an all-star career in Brandon Roy, one a very long career in Nate Robinson. So yeah, by comparison to them, Trey Simmons didn't seem as special. By comparison to this year's team, yes.
Or somebody who could just knock down an open three. Like, it doesn't seem like it should be that hard. You know, it's not like Mike Shaun is talking about where you're ruling out a large percentage of the population because you have to be 6'5" and 300 pounds. You know, there should be some people out there who can knock down an open three. And somehow Mike Hopkins has managed to find zero of them. But
I mean, Marcus Sahonis is 38% from three and Jamal Bates 51%. So I would say zero, but certainly not enough.
But Trey Simmons, what did Trey shoot that year?
He was better the next year. That year, Trey shot 40% from three. The next year, he shot 42% and averaged 2.5 per game.
Well, so really not even that much. I mean, this was still probably the early era of three-point shooting.
No, not 2.5 attempts, 2.5 makes per game.
And that's, you think that's good?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that good by modern NBA standards?
I mean, it still puts you in the top 40 or 50 in the NBA. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this. College games are shorter than NBA games.
All right, fair enough. But yeah, I mean, Trey Simmons.
I mean, like, granted, yeah, like Gary Trent Jr. definitely averages more than 2.5 three-pointers per game, but that's because Gary Trent Jr. is amazing.
So
2.5 would rank you, I mean, it wasn't exactly 2.5, but that would rank you like 27th
in college.
In the NBA.
Project, are you extrapolating 2.5 to per 48 minutes?
No.
Just on its own.
That's how many teams.
Wow.
Yeah. 2.5 is a lot, man. He actually averaged 2.4 technically. So
it really
that drops him down
like,
to like 36th in the league.
It feels like so many players. Like if you were like, does Jokic hit 2.5 threes a game? I'd be like, sure, of course. Everybody does.
Jokic like, does not hit 2.5 threes per game.
Wow. Okay, that's fascinating information to learn. It just feels like everybody does in the modern NBA. But no, I mean, this makes that Trey Simmons season even more incredible. And having that performance against Arizona, I mean, it is, that's really, I think, what made this team so
their
exciting.
Ability to beat Arizona is what made this team, if we're going to be honest.
They were very good at beating Arizona. But there was more. We'll get to it next week. It wasn't just
sure
Arizona.
Will.
We'll get to it in the tournament also. You know, like the.
Well, we're not going to get to. Oh, in the Pac-12 tournament, yes.
They beat more than just Arizona, but they were very good at.
But that was also their notable win in the Pac-12 tournament, Pac-10 tournament. I don't want to spoil that.
But I think the depth that they had, what you were talking about, like there were four future NBA players, making it so that somebody like Trey Simmons felt like he was a role player on the team, but he could he could drop 30 points against Arizona off the bench.
I mean, yeah. I mean, Trey Simmons is someone who was good enough to go to training camp in the NBA. He was in camp with the Sonics his first season, enjoyed an extremely long international career. And for that to be like your fifth best player on the team, that is an embarrassment of riches.
What all I'm saying is that I will ride for Trey Simmons forever.
For sure. I mean, I gave away the Trey Simmons jersey that I came across in the Sonics archives to a friend who went to Garfield and appreciated it even more than I would. But that was quite
Sonics
a collectible
Trey Simmons jersey.
Yeah, he never put it on other than media day, sadly.
Trey Simmons never put it on. Your friend wears it a lot.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Like me and my Michael Jelliball jersey.
I definitely was very excited to write a story about Trey Simmons when he was in Sonics training camp.
I was telling the children we were driving to Olympia this weekend when I was too busy to go get chicken. And there was like a Sasquatch bumper sticker or something. They were asking about Sasquatch and they were like, is Sasquatch real? And I was like, yeah, Sasquatch is real. A real ass, if you ask me.
that might be my favorite quote ever on this podcast.
And I was recalling, Mrs. Fantasy Genius was talking about Squatch used to flirt with her. And my ongoing feud with Squatch... I know that we've talked about this on the podcast before, but also that I won the seats in the Lazy Boy courtside and just asked for every single other person the entire year, whenever they did this promotion, there were two Lazy Boys for people to sit in. And we just asked for a third. And the Sonics at the time were like, sure. Yeah, that seems reasonable.
Which, to be clear, you had this opportunity because I got you in the, what was it, 90s trivia?
I think it was 80s or 90s. I can't remember.
It was definitely either 80s or 90s night.
But I slayed 80s or 90s night. Look, I don't remember which year, which decade it was, but I remembered a lot of things about that decade. I think it was 90s. Melrose Place was the one that I missed. I missed one question.
Like, you got the question wrong, or that was the only one you didn't correctly answer?
I think I got it wrong. I think I might have said Beverly Hills 90210 instead of Melrose Place.
Where you got?
Yeah. So, but also, this was like, what year do you think that was? 2006?
We were in the office on Elliott Avenue. So, for sure, it wasn't 07-08. It was either 05-06 or 06-07.
It was definitely like the Wild West of Sonics years. When you got down to asking me to do the halftime show.
Well, one of the other contestants was the brother of another Sonics employee. So there were multiple siblings.
Look,
involved.
I fucking crushed them all. And I got those three Lazy Boys. I earned those three Lazy Boys fair and square. I just really love that it's like...
No, you didn't. That's not fair and square.
But no, maybe it wasn't fair and square, but I earned them, right? I won the contest at halftime, didn't I?
Yes. I won
the contest at halftime, fair and square. I just love thinking back on that and being like, they were like, here are your two tickets and Lazy Boys behind the hoop. And I was like, ooh. Can you make that three Jans gotta go?
We should have her on to talk about her memory of this.
And
experience.
They said yes. I'm like, sure, we'll wheel out another Lazy Boy. Who was the dude? Was I was told explicitly that I would not have to shoot from half court. Damon, was that his name? I'm pretty sure that was his name.
I believe it was Damien.
Damien, who ran game ops. And he was like, all right, so when I arrived, you told me, you were like, no way you shoot from half court. I think I practiced a little bit just in case. And then I showed up and he was like, all right, so when you shoot from half court, here's what it's going to... And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I was told that I wasn't going to be shooting for half court. And he said, that's how we roll. It's like, you want that third Lazy Boy? You got to shoot from half court, buddy. And Squatch is going to make fun of you about it for the rest of the year.
It didn't happen subsequently, did it? It's not like you came to a later game and...
No, he made fun of me every time he saw me for the rest of the year. Which, look, there weren't a lot of fans in those games. Squatch saw me a lot. We'd be like season ticket holder night. I'm there. It's like me and Jan and Mrs. Fantasy Genius trying to get Chris Wilcox's autograph or whatever. And then Squatch comes up and is flirting with my girlfriend and making fun of me for airballing a shot from half court.
It's a real tough life you got there.
I had to explain to the children it was a friendly rivalry. I was like, I knew the person. It was fine. I don't actually have a rivalry with a Sasquatch. It was all in good fun.
As far as you know. Well. On that note.
You're not going to go through these Seahawks minor news. I mean, Alex Collins re-signing on a minimum deal. That doesn't.
I already referenced
call
it.
Call us when Alex Collins has a feud with a Sasquatch. His opportunities will be slightly higher should an NBA team move back to Seattle.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. I don't know why I think that's so funny. Just being like, yeah, we need three. Give me three. I wish that I remembered the moment of shooting from half court better. And I wish that I had another shot at it.